Okay, good evening, everyone. It's good to have you with us again tonight. Here in Carolina, it's been a beautiful day today, and I had to go make a little trip to the doctor, but we got that taken care of. And I did somehow or another forget.
And the alarm went off.
You forget to turn off my...
You getting up at 8:30, I guess.
My fire alarm or something. Something took off anyway. We're going to be back again in Leviticus 26 with our study on the word walk. And as I mentioned before, there's several places that were mentioned here as far as walk, both the walk of man, the manner of life that man has, and of course, God's dealings with man. And dealing with man as having been, man having been in Egypt, and man having picked up the things of the world that they picked up while they were in Egypt, and of course, being brought out of Egypt, and put in their land, and God was pretty plain with what he was saying here concerning idols, idol worship, the things of the world and the things of that they picked up from the heathen in the land of Egypt. Because, you know, when we go back and we think back to it, we remember that the reason they were in Egypt was that there was food there. And, you know, man, of course, lives by the land and what he can make off the land. That's what God told Adam when he put him out of the garden. You know, you're gonna live by the sweat of your brow, and it's going to come from the land. And of course, in that land, it's going to have thorns and thistles and the things that are sticky as you go along. You know, there it's not going to be a garden anymore. Okay. It's going to be right opposite of that of the garden. And so, they were out of Egypt and over there and dealing with the land, Jehovah charged them with what we've been dealing with here for the last couple of times that I had, obedience and disobedience and punishments. And, you know, he told them, says, early on in the chapter 26 of Leviticus, obedience and blessings just go so far. And after he told them about the obedience and the blessings that was expected for the obedience, because God seems to always bless those who obey him and obey his word and obey his will. But then for disobedience, there's punishment that goes along with disobedience. And we went down through at least through three of them, or three of the punishments, and part of the disobedience in the third punishment phase. And we got down to verse 24, I think last week, where we dealing with the fourth set of punishments there in 24 on to verse 39 of this chapter. And it deals with the five disobediences and the five punishments. And he makes it rather clear as to what he will do if they don't heed his words. And of course, we know by their actions that they did not heed what he says. And of course, this is, for the record, this is study six in this study of walk. And this is October the 8th. This will be the second study in October that we're doing so far. And I want to go back to 23 and pick up verses 23, and then we'll go from there, because you got the if and thens there. And of course, the if and thens, there's four occurrences of if and thens in this chapter, and we're my note said we'll be looking at three of them. So we find it in verse 3 and 4 of 26, and then we go down we go down to 23, and it says this. We'll start in verse 23. And if you will not be reformed by me by these things, but will walk contrary to me. And we talked about walking contrary, and that's back in 21. Contrary gives us the idea of a hostile encounter. You know, if you you can meet someone and have dealings with them, and it can either be peaceful or hostile. These people were going against the will and wishes of God, and these things became hostile in the encounter. So he says, if you'll not be reformed by me by these things, but will walk in a hostile manner unto me, then I will also walk contrary unto you. So, 24 there, again, is contrary there, I think, is again, in gives you the same sense of understanding that I will also walk contrary to you, or with my part of this hostile encounter, because it seems like if one side is going to be hostile, then there is no peace. You know, you have to have agreement in order to have peace. Mm-hmm. And so this was not an agreement as far as what God wanted. It was not an agreement. It was not something that God would stand for. And so let's read 24 again. It says, if and then, if in 23, then in 24, I will also walk contrary unto you, and will punish you yet seven times for your sins. Here again is the number seven. Again, and we went over that a week or so ago, talking about the number seven being a perfect number. It was the number of creation. And it rules, incubation and gestation periods for basically for all things on earth. And so, we see the great significance in the number seven, and certainly, it has the stamp of God all over it, the number seven does. So that's quite interesting there in my mind, too. And so he's going to walk as they're walking, because it's not a peaceful thing. It is one of division here, if you want to look at it that way. And he says in 25, and I will bring a sword upon you. So, in my mind, you know, God is not in the realm of pulling a sword on people, because God is love, and certainly He would like for love to abound, but He will allow things. And so here, He is saying, I think in my view anyway, I will allow this terror to happen upon you by your enemies. So He's going to use those that they were going to drive out of their land to combat them on behalf of God, because it's part of God's punishment for that sort of thing. And you know, we look at this and we say, well, how could a God of love do this? Well, He has set down the rules and He set down the regulations, and He has made agreements with them and agreements with their fathers and forefathers, and they're just not heeding to all this, even after He has given them the land, even after they have drawn lots and got their land, they're just not doing what the agreement was, the contract was between the children of Israel and God. So He says this, bring a sword upon you that shall avenge the quarrel of my covenant. So that's the reason. There is a quarrel with His covenant. It is.
They said, yeah, we'll do all.
Yeah. We'll do it, but when it gets down to it, they won't do it. And so, therefore, they got to pay the price, the consequence. Okay, and when ye are gathered together within your cities, basically within your houses, when you're gathered together within your houses, wherever it be that you live, you know, I will send the pestilence among you, and you shall be delivered into the hands of the enemy. So they were going to be gathered together. They were withdrawn or escaped to their own place, or what they call their place. But there still is not going to be any safety there. So the pestilence there that he talks about is number 1698 in the Strong's, and it's a sense of destroying. So pestilence gives you an idea that times are going to be bad, that it's going to be, in my view or my picture of it, it's going to be a war. It's going to be an enemy there. And the enemy is not happy. And if somebody come in to take your land or our land or who's ever, you know, even in today's age, we would not be happy. And for sure. But it says, for the rest of that, and you shall be delivered into the hands of the enemy. So there's no peace and safety here. There was promised, that God promised back when He was giving them all this in the early part of this chapter. And He says there's no peace and safety here. And He had promised them peace and safety. But they broke their part of the covenant. So
peace,
there is no peace and
peace
safety.
Peace and safety kept coming from
to be had.
Being in the, within the
covenant. In the covenant, in the will of God, in doing what was right and good before Him. Walking before Him in the manner and in the way that He would have them to go. They just didn't do that. verse 26. And he says, "And when I have broken the staff of your bread, 10 women shall bake your bread in one oven, and they shall deliver you your bread again by weight, and ye shall eat, and not be satisfied." So he says in 26, that when I've broken the staff of your bread, and there's a note in the companion side there in verse 26 about broken the staff of your bread, and that is a metalithus, a figure, metalithus in appendage 6. And bread there is being put for the support it gives to human beings and the staff which it is. And the breaking of the staff is put for the cutting off of the supply. And, you know, you can find this in Isaiah 3:1, Ezekiel 4:16, 5:16, and then in chapter 14:13, also in Psalms 105:16. And then we talk about the word 10. Because 10 is there, it says, in 26, and 10 women shall bake your bread in one oven. So this is, they're getting down here to where 10 families will have the use of one oven. So it seems like that it gives you a kind of a picture of people leaving their home or leaving their land and fleeing and becoming what do you call these people that flee their country and go into another country? Fugitives. They're
refugees.
They have fled. And they're gathering together wherever they can to eat their bread. And then all of them's doing it. 10 families is doing it out of one oven. And it says, "And they shall deliver your bread again by weight," which is meted out. And it seems to be that weight there is a... again, it kind of goes back to not having enough, not having a supply that they need, because it says that they shall eat and not be satisfied. They'll have a little to eat,
but it ain't enough.
It's not really enough to suffice for those families. So you see how he's putting it here. He's putting it in very exact, simple terms, but yet the picture is much bigger than that as to how they had gotten away from what God had wanted them to do. And then we get down to 27. Here's another if and then. And it says, "And if you will not, for all this, hearken unto me," and hearken there, we talked about hearken there again, and that was verse 14, if we go back to verse 14, because that was the very start of these punishments here. But in 14, it talks about, let me find it. Here, the word is Shema, and will not hearken. And he wanted them to hear intelligently, attentively, and obediently, to give ear, to listen, to understand, or to witness to. But he says, okay, if that don't get your attention. You know, will this get your attention? And if you will not for all this, if this don't get your attention, hearken unto me, but walk contrary to me. And again, that walking contrary is one of the things that we've already discussed today. But walk contrary again, verse 21. And 21 again is hostile. To walk hostile or to be, to have this hostile attitude. And so they are, for all these things that he's dealing out to them, it seems like it didn't faze them. They still were on the same path to do what they had been doing. He said that was, that walk there is 32:12 in the Strong's. That's man's walk. But he says in 28, then I will walk. And I will walk there is number 1980 in the Strong's. And this is where God says he walks. And that's a different situation. And he said, I will walk contrary. To you also in fury. And I, even I, 28 there, I, even I, will chastise you 7 times for your sins. Here again is the number 7. And so he's still doing things right by the numbers. It's coming down to that very, very situation. So he says, I'll walk contrary. I'll walk also with a hostile encounter, in fury. And I will even chastise or punish you 7 times for your sin. And we've looked at those numbers there, and it's always the same, the 7 times. And so he goes on to say in 29, and you shall eat the flesh of your sons, and the flesh of your daughters shall ye eat. He says, even bring you down to the point to where you will eat human flesh to live. Even your own sons and daughters. Now
that's pretty bad.
That is, even your own. You know, this gets about as bad as it can get. And, so he's driving the point home over and over again. It's the, you know, these are the covenant breakers. And the punishment is great. Very great. And then he gets on into verse 30 where he talks about the idols and so on. And he says, and I will destroy your high places. And the high places there is used in Numbers, the book of Numbers, for in Deuteronomy also for idolatrous worship. And they also had what they call sun idols. I think we talked about it a little bit before, that they would take these idols and color them up for brightness. And I think this is was their attempt to explain in idol form, the Shekinah, their Shekinah. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that last night when Brother Mike was making his study on the Shekinah. Well, you see, even the heathen puts their sun gods up above the other gods and the other idols in these places or these fertility gardens or whatever, you know, they are in these places. And so, like the cherubim overshadowed the mercy seat, yeah. And where the Shekinah come was at, then these idol worshipers were doing basically the same kind of stuff. And I thought, gee, you know, and that's something new to me. I hadn't considered that, but they did have what they call sun gods or sun idols.
Yeah.
And so that's what he's talking about. The high places, I think. And it's used for idolatrous worship. And the note says, thus showing the helplessness of the gods worshiped. And, the image is there. And in the Hebrew, it's, Hamanim, and it means sun gods. And this was the one that they, I think they got the idea from what they understood that the mercy seat and all that in the Holy of Holies where the priest went in, they understood what that looked like so they could make the same thing. See, I think that is something of a satanic ritual that imitates the real thing, you know, because if Satan can make an imitation to make it look like the real thing, then it's easier to sell in that sense. So he also says the images, the sun gods, and it talks about also the carcasses. So I will destroy your high places and cut down your images and cast your carcasses upon the carcasses of your idols, and my soul shall abhor you. And that word, my soul, in the Hebrew is nephesh. And that my soul there is a figure, anthropopathia, and that is an attribute of showing that it's God, you know. And certainly things that man have are figures of that we understand that is God. And so that anthro there, popathia, is the attributing that to God of which man has. And then you have another word that goes along with that you find in verse 34 and 35, that word is prosopopathia, and that means the things that pertains to man. You know, the anthro is the thing that pertains to God, and the pro is the things that belongs to man or the earth. And so that's the difference in the two words. There, if you go back to Appendix 6 and look at it, you see. So, and he says, "My soul shall abhor you." And certainly, this is reverse of what you read in verse 11, I think. Because in verse 11 it says, "And I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you." So there's been a change here. There's a difference in God's dealing with man according to what man has done. In verse 31, he says, "And I will make your cities waste, bring your sanctuaries into desolation, and I will not smell the savor of your sweet odors." And that smell there is anthropopathia too, and that means God can smell these odors, because he says when the fire was put under the offerings made upon the altar, that the sweet smell came up to God, that he could smell that, that he was there for the smell, for the sweet odors. In 31. So in 31 it says, talks about, the cities being waste, being uninhabitable. And the sanctuaries, that's, their holy places, was brought down to ruin. You know, over and over again in Jerusalem we find that, whenever they use the root Jerusalem as the holy place, that these places that was made to worship God was brought to desolation many times. I believe it. One time I was looking at it, I believe it said it was 27 times it had been brought down to ruin in some fashion or other. And it's in ruin now. Mm-hmm. But coming one more time, that's 4 times 7. Yeah. So the 28th time, I think, will be a different situation in that. So he says, "I will not smell the odor or sense the odor. I will not allow my senses to sense that odor. Or your sweet odor." Now, David was a sweet smell unto God, but not those who were doing this. And if you will, sometimes go to Isaiah 11 and look at Isaiah 11:1 and then Isaiah 1. In 11, 1 and 23. Or in, to understand the reason why he would not receive their smell. The covenant, was to be made with sacrifice. And certainly they weren't in position to make the sacrifice, so he was not going to be in the position to receive that odor. Certainly not. And he said in 32, "And I will bring the land into desolation, and your enemies which dwell therein shall be astonished at it." So in 32, he's going to bring the land into ruin. Being uninhabitable to the Jews. And I made a little note there, and I said, man, the enemies there, those that possess the land to begin with, they're going to say, "Wow, what's going on here?" But you see, there's, I don't suppose they would understand God's dealing with his people in this way. In that situation, but certainly the people would, because they've got it here in God's Word. It's in His words. So, verse 33 says, "And I will scatter you among the heathen, and will draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate, and your cities waste. So, he said, I will scatter you among the heathen. And scatter there is like the word sow. He says, in God's eyes, I can sow you where I will, you know. So the word sow there is a good word for scatter, I think, among the heathen or the nations. We'll draw out a sword after you as one would do that, getting ready for battle. You know, if, in those days, if someone drew their sword, they meant business. It was not going to be a pleasant time. So somebody was going to get run through. And so as one gets ready for battle, the sword is going to be drawn. And the land is going to be desolate. And it's not going to yield food. And we've talked about that in some extent there about the women in the ovens. But it's going to be laid in waste. It's not going to be a producer. And the cities, again, is going to be uninhabitable. It's going to be in ruin. It's, you know, when we look at all these places where they're fighting wars, we look and we see, man, that now is nothing but a pile of rubble. It's trash upon trash. And it says in verse 34, then shall the land enjoy her Sabbaths as long as it lieth desolate, and you be in your enemy's land. So they're going to be evidently going to be carted away into the land of the heathen. It says, even then shall the land rest and enjoy her Sabbaths. Well, this is another situation that evidently when the people got their land, they didn't reverence the Sabbath day that God told them to rest. And so they worked the land right on, evidently, to the point that it said the land, then shall the land enjoy her Sabbaths. And that's that word, prosopopathia. And you go back to chapter 18:25, and I think you will get the understanding or the idea of what he's talking about here. That the land needs rest also. And
yeah, because they were commanded, you know, by the law, you do it this way.
Yeah.
Broke that way. And it didn't change the law. No work, the law kept going, yeah.
They just refused to do that. And it says, as long as it lieth desolate, and you be in your enemy's lands, so, you know, it's not being worked. The land is not being worked. It is idle. In 34. They said, then at that time shall the land enjoy her Sabbath as long as it lieth desolate, or lies in waste, or it's not worked. Because that was one of the things that when God says he's going to rest on the Sabbath, he's going to rest on the seventh day.
And so was the land.
And so the land was going to rest. Everything was going to rest. And that was the way he put it into motion. And guess what? They didn't do that. He said, even then shall the land rest and enjoy her Sabbath. It's like almost as if the land could feel the difference.
You know, that's going to be, that's still to be fulfilled.
Yeah. Okay. In 35. And it says this, and as long as it lieth, that's what it shall rest. Because it did not rest in your Sabbath when you dwelt upon it. So, he is really giving them the answer there, or the reason for doing this. And so it says, as long as it's desolate, as long as the land is desolate, it shall rest. It shall prosopo patia. That's the same word for enjoy, and it's the same word for rest. Verse 36. And upon them that are left alive of you. So we find here that evidently many has died.
Yeah, didn't stay alive.
I will send a faintness into their hearts in the land of their enemies, and the sound of a shaken leaf shall chase them, and they shall flee as fleeing from a sword, and they shall fall when none pursueth. That kind of reminded me of when they crossed the Jordan River and they went into the promised land and they came to Jericho, which was a walled city, and they were going to take Jericho. And they were told, if you remember the story, to march around the city
and
do it seven times. And whenever the seventh time come up, the walls would fall in. You know, it would fall in. It was unseen. That was an unseen power. It worked there that did that. And so when I read this, I can't hardly help but think about the same situation here. The unseen thing, because he says, and upon them that are left alive of you, I will send a faintness in their hearts. And so we can glean, I think, from this that many have died off, but send the faintness there is, and the Strong's is 48:16, and it's Mobek, and it means fear. So there is fear going to be sent in the land of their enemies, and it's going to be, this fear is going to be directed to the heart of the Israelites that are left alive. And so much so, that fear is so great. And think on this. And it says, and the sound of a shaken leaf shall chase them. I don't know about everybody, but we've all hunted and, you know, and times passed in the woods growing up. We hunted and you didn't want to walk where you would shake or rustle any of the leaves. If you were going to stalk something, you know, it would spook the game that you were after. So here, even a rustle of a leaf would cause them to shake and quake. And it said they shall flee as a fleeing from a sword. It's like somebody was after them with a blade. even just the movement of a leaf, the shaking, the rustle of a leaf could do that.
No,
in the sense. So that gives me.
No fight left in them.
Gives me an idea that God has taken all of their power away. They don't have anything left. It's they're kind of like a bowl of Jello, you know. They're just that way. And it said, "They shall fall when none pursueth." So they're so edgy, they're going to run even if nobody's in sight. If they just hear a rustle of a leaf. And certainly, the Spirit of God or the wind or whatever could make a leaf rustle to that extent. Verse 37. It said, "And they shall flee." And flee there is not walk. You know, we've been doing a study in walk, but they're running. This is not walking, but running. And it said that they would fall, and they shall fall. And that's to be tripped up. How many times, even in the New Testament, have we heard the word stumbling block? You know, even in today's vernacular, people watching a ball game, every once in a while, a player will be doing something, all of a sudden he'll just, for no reason, trip up, you know. And so they talk about, you know, the sod jumping up at him. So this is kind of in the same realm there, that to be that unsteady, you're so unnerved at that point that you can't be even steady on your feet. And it said, "When one none pursueth." So all this is being done where nobody can be seen. It's an unseen situation. Verse 37. And it said that they shall fall one upon another, as it were before, so were where none pursueth, and ye shall have no power to stand before your enemy. So I think we've made that pretty clear in the former verse, that there's no power to stand before the enemy. You cannot resist, or you cannot fight. That's the situation that the Israelites would be in. Verse 38, kind of interesting verse here. We're about to get through. 39 will be the last one. And it said, "You shall perish among the heathen, and the land of your enemies shall eat you up." And perish there is number 6 in the Hebrew. The number 6 is on the first page. And it means not to have a way of escape. So they did not have a way of escape. But now in the Greek, it is number 622. When you get over into the New Testament, and it's apolomi. Mm-hmm. And it means to destroy fully. So you see, one place it means one thing. Brother Mike made that quite clear between Shekinah and light. You know, you see a lot in the New Testament in his study last night about light. And over in the Old Testament, it was Shekinah. Of course, in the Greek, it was doxia or something like that. But, you've got the same words, basically, but they differ. Yeah, doxia. And then verse 39. It says, and they that are left of you shall pine away in their iniquity in your enemy's land, and also in the iniquities of their fathers shall they pine away with them. So, iniquities there is perversity, or perversities. And perversities in that sense is to be bent or made crooked, to be bent out of shape or be made crooked. In the English there, when you look in that word is, Ava, and that's appendage 44:6 in the Companion Bible. And if you look at it in the English, it means wrong or run out of course. So they were wrong, or they were wrung out of course. It was like, and I kindly think of the explanation of what happened to the one that betrayed Jesus when he went out.
Judas.
That he was wrung, or
in the potter's field.
Yeah, and that he was wrung out of course. He lost it all in that situation. So we'll pick up another grouping next time, and go on with this. This was a little bit morbid in a sense, but God was making a point to his people. After bringing them all the way out of Egypt, bringing them through the wilderness and the journey on, and then going into the promised land, and they still did not do what? They didn't walk before God as he intended them to walk. And so he made it quite clear that if they were not going to walk that way, that his walk was going to be contrary to them, every fashion, every way that he could make it, and it was going to be seven times greater.
How would you like to have the knowledge that it was the God of the universe that told you that? Because you just know.
Awesome, man. Awesome.
You just know it's going to happen.
Yeah, and, you know, and if you've already done it, you'd have to say, uh-oh, you know.
Yeah, here it comes.
But it's coming. It's going to come. But this was something that God would not accept. He was not going to accept. So maybe we'll get into a little lighter part of this thing next time. But it, like I say, it's there was 212 times the word walk shows up in the Bible. And so we've only went through just a few of them, but they were so many here in this section that I really couldn't pass it up. I wanted to get it out. And so we realized, if you didn't get anything else from this, we need to realize how great God's grace is through his Son, Jesus.
That's what I was going to say.
That is the awesome thing here. When Paul talks about this great gift, this free gift, this unspeakable gift that he continually refers to in the person of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. That is something that just floors me. It gets me. So thanks for your time. And if nothing else, I hope at least you can see that and get that from it. Okay, Ron.